Welcome to this week's Rider Support.
This week, we're going to talk about when you should consider taking testosterone. Shimano have a new 13-speed groove set. But before all that, we're going to talk about the Giro d'Italia and our race organisers deliberately endangering riders for viewer entertainment. Let's jump right in. Sarah.
Anthony, how are you? Let's jump into these questions. A few juicy ones this week. Right, let's get cracking. Hi, Anthony and Sarah. I've been watching cycling racing for a few years now, and something I always wondered, and it was brought home even more by Geraint Thomas's comment after a stage in the Giro d'Italia this week, where he was commentating on how dangerous the stage was. I know that cycling racing is dangerous, but are the organisers pushing it too far now with crazy routes, really punishing terrain, and finishes like the one we saw in Naples? What do you think?
Geraint is great value, I think. He always has these quotes, like what was his quote, "We're clowns in a circus"?
Yeah, I mean, he's very outspoken because he's really like a veteran in the peloton.
Won the Tour of France, you can do what you want.
You can do whatever you want. Yeah, exactly. He's got that.
Before I answer that, and to be fair to G, he was super composed earlier in the week when, after his time trial, the Eurosport interviewer asked him the most dissensitive, patronising question. He talked about how Arensman and everyone else on the team, basically Ghana, performed super in the time trial, except him. And he just replied, "Thanks, mate."
I'd say that interviewer got brought in by, it was Eurosport interviewer, got brought in by the bosses and got like spanked over that, because that was really appalling. And you could tell Geraint kept his composure beautifully. He's like,
I would have absolutely lost it.
Yeah, he was drinking out of a bottle at the time. I'm surprised he didn't empty the bottle over the interviewer's head. You could tell he was pissed off, but he really kept his composure. And he's such a stalwart of the sport. You just trust everything that Geraint says. Well, I do anyway. And I think that when he says that a race, he came down to this, was this the stage where he came down or was brought down?
No, he came down earlier in the stage, but not related to the finish.
Right, okay.
Just, you know, a Giro crash as it is, a pinch point. But yeah, no, the finish in Naples, it's
kind of infamous, isn't it?
I don't know. They finished there a lot.
Yeah, but I think apparently there's like big sinkholes. The roads are really bad. There's potholes everywhere and your chain is just rattling around as you're kind of coming into Naples.
Like Adam Hansen is the CPA. He's the rider union president and he gets it in the neck for this stuff on Twitter all the time. But the problem is how these finishes are decided. You have a race organizer who essentially just figures out the route. They figure out the route and they say, we're going to finish in Naples. They plan the whole route. Now, they can go to stakeholders. So an example of a stakeholder would be the local authority. The CPA is another stakeholder, even maybe consultation with some of the team bosses around these stage finishes. But there's no like compulsion on the race organizer to actually give any weight to what the CPA have said. Now, I would love to see a bit more transparency around, did the CPA actually make submissions around this finish, specifically the one in Naples that we're talking about? But as far as I know, I haven't seen any of that and I don't think you can get access to it. But I think you're right. It is race organizers making stuff more dangerous for our entertainment. It's as simple as that. Even if you go on to Discovery Channel, we're, you know, in a post-GCN world for the app, you go on to Discovery Channel now and it has these helpful timestamps to show you stuff. But the stuff of interest during the race, it's crashes. It's crash, crash. People are interested in it. People are, if it bleeds, it leads. People are interested in this.
We've been interested in this kind of in entertainment or pain for entertainment for the viewer, this voyeurism, since the word go, since we were in the Colosseum watching people fighting lions and tigers and stuff. So it's kind of inherent in us. And unfortunately, this is what gets eyeballs on races. This is what gets viewership, this kind of jeopardy. And that's like what the organizers, what cycling, what live sport has, is this kind of excitement and not really knowing what the outcome is. And if the organizers are throwing a little bit of salt and pepper in there, a little bit of spice, and making it even more difficult, where, you know, groups are coming down, it looks a bit sketchy, your heart is in your mouth when you're watching it. That is like cocaine.
But I disagree that should be a part of it at all. I don't think that's part of it.
No, I agree with you.
The parkour should be that.
I don't think it should be part of it, but this is what the human interest is.
No, you can't broadly say that's the human interest though, Sarah. That's like a certain group of people. Like, I hate watching that. Like, heart of my mouth trying to watch it. Like, Geraint Thomas talked about leaving a gap so he could see the potholes in front of him. And then, to quote him, and he said, some idiot dive bombs into it every time you leave a gap. So in that sense, riders don't help themselves.
Yeah.
But it's terrifying. Like, when I see these finishes, I feel like, oh, I'm back in a race and the exact same thing is happening to me. And I hate that feeling. I hate watching the race, knowing that that's somebody's son, knowing that that's somebody's husband, that's somebody's wife, their boyfriend, girlfriend, and they're watching it just like on their wit's end. I hate that that's a part of the sport.
But you're so close to racing and have been so close to racing, and I don't think that's everyone's viewpoint. I mean, take the sprint finishes, for instance. That's another kind of massive case of jeopardy where everybody knows, has a kind of understanding as to how dangerous it is, how quickly it can go wrong. And that's the draw, that's the pull, that's the excitement. More eyeballs on the screen, more eyeballs on the races, bigger and more and better sponsors that will come to the sport.
But the risks need to be risks that the riders are consenting to take. Yeah. That's where it's different.
Yeah.
So if we talk about a sprint finish, the risk the riders are consenting to take is they're banging off each other, they're going through gaps. A risk they're not consenting to take is the legs of the barriers sticking out and they hit the legs of the barriers that cause a crash. I think that's where the difference lies. And the finish in Naples, I've no problem with there being a twisty parkour, a load of turns, but sinkholes and massive potholes, it's not a part of the game. I think the sport's dangerous enough.
Exactly.
It doesn't need this extra jeopardy.
That's exactly what this writer wrote in, just that it's a crazy dangerous sport regardless, without all of these extra bits being thrown at the riders. I think the CPA does a good job. We've had Hansen on the podcast, and he's a brilliant advocate. I always say he shoots from the hip and he says it as it is. I'm just wondering about, you know, okay, Geraint says it, he comes out straight and says it, that was absolutely idiocy kind of having that finish. But can the riders come together in an even more conjoined way and say, let's revolt, let's not do this, let's...
No, they're notoriously disjointed. That's
exactly
the problem.
That's the problem, because you've got the young riders coming up and they're like, oh, feck it, I'm invincible, that doesn't matter to me. And then you've got the riders like Geraint, you're like, this is just crazy, crazy, crazy. So that's the crazy world of racing.
Number two. Rob Mann, I know how serious you take your goal setting, whether they're fitness or life-related goals. If you're looking for a powerful ally to support you on this journey, look no further than Huel. Huel has become my secret weapon for when I don't have time to prepare a balanced meal. It ensures I get the nutrition I need without sacrificing time or taste. Plus, it stops me from reaching for that takeaway menu. I always throw a bottle into my backpack when I'm heading into the city to work, and it stops me eating junk convenience foods, snacking on croissants and bars of chocolate, because I know they don't support my training goals. It's a handy, nutritious meal on the go, and it's got over 22 grams of protein. Huel is perfect for athletes that don't have time to cook or prepare food before a training session. It's convenient, nutritious fuel at your fingertips, ensuring you hit your daily fueling needs for that session. Huel Ready to Drink has 26 essential vitamins and minerals in every single bottle. You're getting a whopping 175 health benefits. Plus, it's made from natural ingredients like tapioca, sunflower seed, coconut, and more. The best part is the flavors. There's 8 crazy beautiful flavors. Iced coffee is what's in my backpack right at the moment. You can get Huel directly to your home. All you got to do is head on over to the Huel website, huel.com/roadman.
Hey, roadman, I got a full blood work done a few weeks ago and it seems that my testosterone is low. Not critically, but I know this will probably only decline more as I age. Is there anything I can do to stop this? Are there foods or activities that I need to avoid completely? And that's from John.
Does he say what his testosterone number was?
Didn't give that info.
So the normal range is 300 to 1,000 for testosterone. I think I was around 400 last time I got tested and I wasn't really doing anything to optimize it. So I'm going to go back pretty soon and see where it's at. I think before you start, assuming he's not a pro and I'm not sure if, see, the thing is, does he race? Does he not race? We don't have that much detail. Maybe if he's watching on YouTube, he can pop in the comments and let us know below. But if you are racing, you can't start approaching stuff like testosterone replacement therapy because it's on the banned list. If you're not racing, you know, that's something you could definitely consider. But I don't think it's something you should consider until you actually exhausts the other alternatives. Maybe there's stuff in your life that will go through which can help you naturally increase your testosterone levels. Like the basic stuff for creating testosterone, which we absolutely need, it's vitamin D, which I've talked about, and zinc, because they're the precursors that are crucial for making testosterone. They're the raw ingredients. So you need to make sure you're getting them either in foods like oysters, beef, pumpkin seeds for zinc, or you're actually just taking supplements for this stuff. So that's first. Then you can dive in and start consuming stuff like healthy fats, like avocados, nuts, seeds, healthy fish, like tinned mackerel, stuff like that, which is also beneficial. But I would be inclined to say that you should be not looking solely at the number, not looking at it and saying, okay, my number's 200, 250. So I'm outside the normal range. Are you symptomatic? I think that's more important. So the symptoms of low testosterone there, like general lethargy, like low energy levels, lack and drive, you're starting to find it more difficult to put on muscle mass, you're putting on weight easier, libido is dropping. These are telltale signs that you may want to investigate further. If they are present, you know, it is worth maybe talking about, if you're not racing, maybe talking about going to see someone who specializes in it. I would definitely be avoiding stuff like alcohol, like endocrine disruptors. Endocrine disruptors are stuff that's like found in plastics, pesticides, other pollutants. Someone on the podcast talked about toxins, again, massively important because they all mimic estrogen in the body, which inhibits the production of testosterone. Reducing stress and cortisol levels, it sounds cliche and almost no one wants to do it because it doesn't feel like tangible enough to write in a diary, to do mindfulness, to do meditation. But it's all backed in research now that it all helps. So yeah, there's a lot of stuff you can do to tackle this. The first part is being aware of it and then you can start to take action.
Okay, amazing. John, let us know how your libido goes after you take all those actions. Maybe don't forget to write in and tell us. Okay, question number four. Anthony, I've seen a lot of riders in the pro peloton wear nose strips. Do they work and do you ever use them? You know, the nasal strips we saw Tadej Pogačar wear his on the time trial a couple of weeks ago.
I wore them in the Ross last year.
Oh, did you really? Mm. Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah. Okay, so tell us all.
It's like a, have you worn them?
Never.
You should wear them down to the gym next time. You look like a right spanner.
Imagine.
Pushing your sled up and down. There's a spring-like mechanism that's in them and it actually physically forces your nostrils open a little bit more. Now, remember, this is way back. We crossed episode 1000, which we never even talked about. We crossed episode 1000 on the podcast.
Congratulations.
Last week. But do you remember with James Nestor on the podcast?
Yeah, it's quite gone back.
Yeah. Like there's a lot of benefits to breathing out of your nose, to getting more oxygen through your nose. And they help do this. There's two sides to it. Objectively, do they work? Does the data say they work? Studies are kind of mixed if they work or not. The subjective is more important, as it is with a lot of cycling stuff. You know, we talked about, do recovery boots work? Do ice baths work? All of it's in the air. What matters is, do you feel like it works? And I'd say for anyone that's looking for a little bit of a marginal gain, it's a super cheap marginal gain. They are worth trying. I find that I do breathe a little bit easier when I have them on. They kind of loosen up as the day goes on though. Like especially if you have sun cream on and then you're sweating, they kind of lose their, you know, you find yourself.
The tension that they have, it kind of,
I don't know if I finished the stage or went on.
Right, okay.
Yeah, like they get halfway through and they're kind of flapping in the wind like on your sunglasses for it.
Very aero.
They're worth trying if Pogačar's using them. Look, try it.
Yeah, I had a little look at some of the studies and as you said, nothing's definitive. I think that they do say that the benefits of nasal dilator strips are more pronounced in endurance sports that rely heavily on efficient oxygen uptake compared to sports where short bursts of intense efforts are involved. So basically they study professional footballers and endurance athletes and they found that the endurance athletes actually benefited more from using them. But again, there's like about 10 studies that I looked at. And
they've been around years though.
Yeah, no.
Like I remember Robbie Fowler played for Liverpool when I was like, I don't know, 10 or 12 and he was wearing them and that's when I first thought,
all right, that's cool,
he looks cool.
Yeah, Fowler is wearing them. Okay, next question. I saw online that Shimano are releasing a 13 speed, but can you explain what a 12 speed or a 13 speed is? I'm afraid to ask a stupid question in my cycling group, and that's from Jake. And you know what, I don't know what 11, 12, 13 speedas either. And I'm sure I am not the only one. So for the majority of new-ish cyclists, can you set this straight for us?
You used to not know the difference between a tire and a wheel, though.
I still get that one mixed up a lot. We have a lot of outtakes from rider support where I talk about tires and wheels and Anthony gets kind of pissed off me because I continue to get it wrong all the time. And Wes, our editor and column, have to constantly cut it out to kind of be like, oh my God, she's talking about wheels and tires wrong again. But yeah, I mean, as I always say, I don't even know what a bottom bracket is. So explain here what a 13 speed is and why are Shimano releasing this?
Hey Roadman, excuse the short interruption. I love riding the bike, but on account of being so busy with the podcast at the moment, I'm now what's called a time-crunched rider. I never thought I'd see the day. But I have a tool. I'm using Wattbike to keep myself sharp and on point with specific sessions to maximize that available training time. I have a Wattbike Atom right here in the recording studio beside me. And when I have an hour in between interviews, I jump on. It's removing all the friction points from me. There's no more 10-minute setup, unfolding legs, banging my knees off stuff, getting my hands dirty, the usual connection issues. It just works every single time. The Atom's perfect for virtual racing as well because it has crisp gear changes, it has 1% accuracy, and it has max gradient capability of up to 25%. If you're looking for an indoor trainer, I honestly couldn't recommend this any higher. I've been using a Wattbike since 2013. Honestly, it's the last indoor trainer that you're ever going to need. If you head on over to wattbike.com now and use code ROADMAN10, that's ROADMENTEN, and that's going to get you 10% off your Wattbike.
I think the easiest way to think about it is it's not just the amount of speed you have. It's like it's iPhone 12, iPhone 11, iPhone 10. It's the exact same thing. It's just the newest version. It's their Shimano 13 speed. When I started cycling, I was on Shimano Dura-Ace 9 speed. That was my first group set that I bought the bike secondhand. There was 10 speed out at the time. I couldn't afford 10 speed, so I bought Shimano Dura-Ace 9 speed. Exact same way as you might have bought an iPhone 4 back in the day, and now our latest iPhone is iPhone 15. They bring out a new one each year. Like, pragmatically, there are differences. The same way there's different processors in an old iPhone, there's different components in the new Shimano group set. The most notable difference is there's an extra gear each time. So when I started out and I had 9 gears on my rear block, so I could go from, maybe I had a range of something like 11 to 23, but 11 to 23, you have gaps in the cassette because of that. So you might go from 15 to 17 because 11 to 23 is more than 9 speed. So you had gaps back in the day. And then it got to a point where you could have like an 11 to 23 straight through without having gaps. And it's just evolved from that. But there's, to make that extra gear all the time, there is like logistical stuff that has to happen. The chain has to get narrower each time. There has to be more cogs on the back. And as they're doing it, they just generally update the whole group set. So you'll probably have like lighter shifters, better front mechs. It's totally different, to be honest, than my old 9-speed. Like my 9-speed used to shift coming over. And everyone will remember this. If in the comments down below, let me know if this is your experience. But for a long time, if you were in a race and you needed to be in the little ring for the race, for this climb, and then coming over the little ring, it turned into like a plateau where you needed to be in the big ring. You had this moment coming over the top of the climb when you shifted from the little ring to the big ring, that you were almost, say a prayer to the Holy Mary that you wouldn't drop your chain.
Yeah.
And easily 10% of the bunch would drop their chains going over this. It was a very inefficient change from small ring to big ring. Now it's seamless. Like it feels like there's no difference shifting on the front and the back. Like they've done such a brilliant job of evolving each time out.
Yeah, it's quite velvety, isn't it? Because I know one of the tips that you gave me when I first started climbing was, as you are about to get to the top of the hill, that's the time to get into your big ring and really push it rather than waiting till you're coasting down the far side. And even though your group set's under a bit of pressure to do that, it still feels great.
Well, the new stuff is so good. You wouldn't have been able to do that. You would have to wait till it was off tension to do that. And now there's, more of an evolution of this, not from Shimano, but from a company called Classified, where they have an invisible front mech. It's built into internal in the rear hub. So you can shift seamlessly. They're saying up to like 1700 watts or something you can change from little ring to big ring with no drop in chain or no come off the power. Right. When you'd ever need to shift at 1700 watts to your little ring, I don't know.
That's not even my problem. When would I ever be doing 1700 watts?
Yeah. I don't know. Philippe Ogana used it in the TT.
Oh, okay.
So it's the first time we've seen classified in a time trial that I know of as well.
Okay.
A cool little rear disc.
Yeah, I think 13 speed. I could definitely. So basically, it's 13 gears as opposed
on the back.
To. On the back, as opposed to 12 that you ride on. I ride on 11 at the moment. So it's just more options for gearing for climbing or whatever.
That and the total upgrade.
Yeah. Okay. So are you going to get one?
No.
Okay.
I'm a SRAM man these days.
You are a SRAM, yes.
Yeah. Except my Rudy Rider's broke at the moment. Shout out.
Shout out to SRAM.
Folks, thank you for tuning in to another edition of Rider Support. If you do have questions, keep them coming in. You can find Sarah and myself over on X, and we're going to link that in the description below. Also, you can put your questions in the comments down below. We'll troll through those and get back to them next week. There's another video up here. It's a conversation I had with Dan Larang, the high performance physiologist from Bora Hansgrove. Really beneficial if you're looking to know how to structure your training. And down here, you can subscribe to the channel. Chat next day.